very simple equation. If you want to lose weight, if you want to burn fat, you're going to need to have a reduced calorie intake.
Welcome to Forever Young, the health and well-being podcast from Lanzerhof. My name is Mario Pedizzoli, and in every episode, join me in conversation with a variety of health experts and special guests as we explore what it means to live well. We may not find the secret to eternal youth, but join me on our quest as we explore just what it means to live a balanced, healthy, and happy life. Hello again and welcome. In today's podcast, we uncover the truth behind common fitness myths. And with new exercise routines emerging every week, new gurus trending by the day, and just when you're getting the hang of things, a fresh study contradicting all the other ones you had decided to swear by, it's easy to think that fitness is confusing, but it just doesn't have to be. The good news is that the fundamentals stay the same, the science is sound and pretty well agreed, so by simply arming yourself with a few basic facts, you can step into any gym forewarned against whatever fresh nonsense is being peddled on Instagram or anywhere else for that matter. And to help us make sense of it all today is Jason Reynolds, Head of Fitness here at Lanzerhof at the Arts Club. With over 10 years of experience as a personal trainer, reformer Pilates master instructor, and injury rehabilitation specialist, Jason has been leading the fitness team here since the club's opening in 2019. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me, Mario. So it's good to be here and hopefully good to help some people.
Feeling fit today?
Always. A little bit sore from training yesterday, actually.
Fitness myths. Well, they've been around forever, haven't they? Has the internet age simply made the problem worse, do you think?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily worse, but I think more people have access to information, which is great. But those things are sometimes quite random and can be a bit vague. Mm. So what might be relevant for one person might not be relevant for someone else. Mm. So sometimes it's about understanding what they're reading and what that information means for them specifically. Mm-hmm. And training for one person and another can be totally different. Mm-hmm. So it's all goal dependent.
Absolutely. Well, look, for today's show, we thought we'd take a different approach, and we thought we'd get some help in compiling this list of common fitness myths and questions from our listeners, our members, and the Lanzerhof community in general. So thank you, everyone who's contributed. Now, Jason, they all know who you are, so no pressure. Answer. Okay. So, look, there are two recurring themes throughout diet versus exercise and muscle versus fat. So, let's kick off with some of the questions in these areas. If you have built muscle, is the first question, and then you stop training, does the muscle actually turn to fat?
No. Very bluntly, no. And it's probably one of the most amusing myths that we ever hear in the gym. And most any trainer who's been in this industry for a little while will have heard it from someone. No, they are very, very separate entities. That's not how it works. Mm. Gaining muscle is quite difficult, and keeping muscle requires a certain level of maintenance. Mm. If you decide not to train, the muscle size will slowly over time reduce. Mm. But there's also a base level of muscle that we build. If you have your leg put in a plaster cast, for instance, you'll notice your leg gets smaller because not using the muscle will cause it to atrophy and get smaller. And that's a good way of understanding that we need to use our muscles to keep muscle size.
So it doesn't turn to fat. It's just the proportion between muscle and fat has changed.
Yeah, that's all that changes.
Yes.
So more often than not, when you have more muscle, you have less fat as well.
And anecdotally, it takes a long time to build muscle, but it seems, I don't know, annoyingly very quick to
lose it.
Very bluntly, true? Yeah, it is. It is. It's a good way of understanding the discipline of training is that it takes a while to build muscle and to get that sort of physiological change. Mm-hmm. But if you spend 3 weeks on a sofa not doing anything, you'll lose some of it. Mm-hmm. So hopefully anyone who's ever built muscle will keep the discipline to maintain it and continue improving it, hopefully.
Never-ending journey.
Exactly.
Here is another. My clothes are looser. I'm feeling stronger, but I weigh the same. Does muscle weigh more than fat?
Again, the internet was a really good perpetuator of this kind of myth about how much more muscle weighed than fat, or vice versa, or the size difference. And you might have seen photos on the internet of a big blob of fat and a small bit of muscle weighing the same. And That's not entirely true. Yes, muscle is denser and it is slightly heavier. It's probably not nearly as sort of double as some people sort of make out. So yes, if you have more muscle than you had previously in terms of your size, if you're the same weight, etc., you have more muscle. There is a change there, but it's not, you know, it's not 100% change from muscle to fat. It's not double. It's probably 20-30% more, and that's about it.
Okay.
It's the volume of fat is what gives is the change again. It's the body composition change.
Okay, got it. Okay, thank you very much. Next one is, can you please explain the 80% diet, 20% exercise rule? I think that's the premise of the majority of the focus should be on what you eat as opposed to exercise, but maybe expand on that.
Yeah, again, another statement from a popular training book maybe 15, 20 years ago, really kind of went hard on the 80-20 cut. Mm. And everyone will be a little bit individual in that. But there is a lot to say that your diet is incredibly important. You can't out-train a bad diet. It's just impossible. But most people can eat a little bit better and train a little bit better and we'll start to see some improvement. So 80-20 really only applies as a strict rule for athletes and those in really good shape trying to continuously improve it. I think if people stick really firmly to that, it makes their exercise routine very difficult, but also makes their nutrition and diet changes unsustainable. So for an everyday person or someone who's just getting into training or someone who's just starting to want to make changes, it's little incremental bits. Don't worry about the 80-20. It's too much at this point. You just need to think about being a little bit better, either reducing your calories if you're trying to burn body fat or trying to increase the amount of volume or exercise you're doing to build more muscle mass. So 80-20, though correct, isn't, again, necessarily for everyone. It's something that, you know, for athletes more specifically, again, that's where trainers come in, and seeing a trainer and getting that kind of individualized idea about what you need to do is really key. Because for some people, that just won't work because they won't be able to do it.
And is it a simple maths equation related to this of burning more calories than you consume, you will lose weight? Is it as simple as that?
Yes and no. So no.
I thought you might say that.
Yeah. Look, to a large percentage, yes. Nutrition is much more complicated than that. Your hormonal factors, the types of nutrition you're putting into your body, they are very, very important. But on a base level, on a very simple equation, if you want to lose weight, if you want to burn fat, you're going to need to have a reduced calorie intake based upon what your normal daily intake would be, assuming you're doing exactly the same things. So if you take 2,000 calories in and you burn 1,000 calories during your day, then that's your rate and that's where you are. And you have 1,000 calories extra, you're going to put on some weight. But if you increase the amount of exercise you're doing, you bring that number down, again, you're getting into a little bit more of a deficit. That's where we're going to make a change. So it might not necessarily be, it's about just purely an equation, but it's definitely the starting point for most people when they're trying to change their diet.
And then I suppose there are other factors, which includes time of day and when you consume more calories and fewer calories. I guess we'll talk about that later too, but I guess it's never as simple as it.
No, absolutely not. It's incredibly complicated. It can be incredibly complicated. If one doesn't need to, it doesn't always need to be incredibly complicated. Not everyone needs those incredibly high levels of information to make changes, certainly to start with, or at the early points of making changes. As you get further down the line, you're trying to make smaller incremental changes, then you might need to be more specific. But for most people, getting a better sleep habit, a better dietary position in terms of probably reducing the amount of carbohydrates they're having, increasing protein, increasing fats, or even just bringing down the amount of calories they're having if they're trying to lose weight, they're the things to start with. As you get further in, you've got to think about hormonal responses, especially for females, because it's a little bit more of a tightrope to walk. But again, we could do a podcast talking about that alone.
Yes.
And maybe if people want to, we can do that. But it's a very deep subject. But for most people, it's about getting into a slightly better position than they were the week before.
Certainly. And related to that, we've received some comments on exercise plans and the impact that training has on our bodies. And seeing as this podcast is addressing fitness myths, no fitness myth podcast could go without the no pain, no gain question.
So let's talk about that one. That's
been around for time immemorial. Is soreness good for us?
I think, you know, the classic bodybuilders of the day sort of started it, and the Arnold Schwarzeneggers of the world live in that era. They live in that world because that's what they need to do to make changes to their body. It's not for everyone. Not everyone needs to be in pain. It is ultimately a little bit dependent on what you're doing. If your goals involve increasing the amount of muscle mass you have, or getting incredible and really increasing your strength, then the way you do that is create small micro tears in your muscles that then rebuild as a bigger and stronger.
Tear and repair.
And again, doing that on a large scale within like the bigger muscle groups of your body will cause a large amount of soreness. There's no two ways about it.
Yes.
But that is, again, that's reliant on you having enough weight, enough volume, to make that happen. It's not, again, for everyone. It depends on what your goals are. If your goals are about increasing the amount of muscle mass, if you're, you know, a lot of guys might go and do a lot of bench press and want to get a big chest. And if that's the case, every guy that's ever done that will know that you're going to get pretty sore doing it. That's just part of the response. That's when those tears happen, when we get inflammation, there's a buildup of lactic acid, carbon dioxide, water, and that creates a pumped feeling, and that pumped feeling is what creates a little bit of pressure onto the nerves, things like that, that then cause that soreness that we have.
So I suppose maybe back in the day, but even now sometimes, that myth was responsible for a whole swathe of people not wanting to train because
For health-related
fitness, there is no need to experience discomfort of that.
No, absolutely not. You know, if you're trying to move better, you know, have better movement patterns, getting out of, you know, back pain, knee pain, hip pain, no, you don't need to be in pain. You don't need to. There may be times when you start to challenge yourself a little more and you work a little harder and you might feel it a little bit, but it shouldn't be, if it's limiting you the next day in terms of you can't get out of bed, you can't go down the stairs, that's not relevant for people who are rehabilitating or starting to really go through that process. If you move great, you don't have any ailments or pain aches, and you can train hard and you want to improve your muscle mass or really improve your strength, then that's fine. But again, that's a much smaller percentage of the population than those that are trying to be healthy and move well, and trying to keep their body fat down.
And the pain itself, DOMS, maybe you can talk about that. What's happening there? Because day two is often worse than day one in terms of that discomfort.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's scientifically we could go down a bit of a rabbit hole, but effectively it is. It's a buildup of chemicals, and so lactic acid, carbon dioxide, water, all basically released from the muscles, but byproduct of exercise and how we use something called ATP, which is the energy, and how we kind of create energy in our body for our muscles to work. And that basically gets released into the muscle. It then basically gets swollen. The cells get swollen. And that creates a lack of range and creates also a little bit of a suffocating response onto our nerves. Not bad for our nerves, but it means that whenever we move a little bit, we get a lot of soreness because there's just a constant bit of pressure there. So it's not bad. It's just a response that we have.
Yes.
People always kind of related it classically that lactic acid was the reason you got sore. That's kind of almost like a bit of a myth in itself.
Yes.
It was actually science done maybe probably about 100 years ago, maybe even a bit longer now, of someone took blood from a deer, chased it, caught it, took blood test again and wondered why it was slowing down, noticed in its blood test that lactate was higher, and then said, oh well, it must be lactic acid, that's why he slowed down. And that science has really stayed true to this day. We don't actually really know what the specific reason of that is, other than the fact that we lose a bit of range because we've got a lot of cellular inflammation. So the fact that it's just lactic acid isn't true. So if you blame lactic acid, it's not just lactic acid's fault.
Okay, never knew that. And actually, relating to the pain, the soreness, the stiffness, what steps can we take post-exercise to limit that discomfort in the coming days?
There are a few things now that we can do. A lot of people, dependent on kind of where you are price point and depending on what your where you are in the world and what you have access to. Cryotherapy, so cold shock therapy, is a, again, a very popular one, and from a scientific point of view, growing in its popularity. Basically, the cold shock, so not immersion therapy, so not going in cold showers and not sort of ice bath, because they, again, without going too much into it, they'll cause your blood vessels to go away from the skin and to get smaller to kind of protect you. So cold shock is a cold where you're in a the water's not on your skin, as it were. Causes vasodilation, so your blood vessels get bigger, you increase your blood flow, you increase your lymphatic system, which helps get rid of that lactic acid, the carbon dioxide, etc. So you actually reduce some of that soreness, which is perfectly good. So cryotherapy, if anyone's ever done it, is fantastic for this. It's one of the reasons here at Lanzhof we champion it, because it's great, and that's why it's here. Nothing we do is not based on science. There are other options. You can, of course, if you don't have access to that, you know, people aren't going to have them at home. You know, taking cold showers, anyone who's ever read a little bit about Wim Hof or done any of the Wim Hof methods, again, they're equally helpful in terms of the cold. You won't get quite as good response as cryotherapy, because it's a little bit more immersion, cold immersion, so you get a little bit of a different blood vessel response, but you'll still reduce some of that soreness as well. People can take magnesium. You can get magnesium spray. Magnesium, when it's absorbed into the bloodstream, can help reduce some soreness as well. Spray is the best, because it's one of the few ways it can be absorbed properly. If you take it as a supplement, it will barely get out of your intestines with any level that will help you. So buy the spray, because you'll absorb it in a better way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Does weight training, this question was sent in, does weight training make women bulky? And should women lift lower weights and do higher repetitions than men?
No.
Good luck.
Yeah. No and no. Weight training doesn't make women bulky, and no, women shouldn't lift lower weights and higher reps than men. Women don't have have a much lower level of testosterone than men, first and foremost. So for women to get to a point where they have a larger amount of muscle mass than they want, to the point where they would, this described as bulky, is so incredibly difficult. It's such a process. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen the one or two times you lift some weights. It's going to take months and months of doing really hard work to get to a point where you feel like you've grown and built muscle. And if any female ever gets to the point where they've built too much muscle, as we kind of mentioned earlier, just take a few weeks off and you'll lose a bit and you'll be back to a point where you're happy. So having too much muscle is never a problem.
But as you say, it takes a very long time to get to that point. And how many times have we heard in the industry, you know, I don't want to do weights, I don't want to get bulky. And of course, that is a myth.
Look, I've been in this industry, as you said, over 10 years, quite close to 15 now, actually. That means I'm getting a bit older, I guess.
Well, I've got a question on that.
And basically, I've not trained a single person, not a single female. And obviously, I worked predominantly in a women's training environment for a long time as well. And I've never trained a single female that's ever said I'm too bulky. In fact, quite the opposite. When they build muscle, that creates a better silhouette physiologically. They're happier. There's no downside to building more muscle. And if anyone ever gets to the point where it's too much, then just take a few weeks off. It's really simple. And the second part of that is about, should women lift lower weights and do higher repetitions? Now, one of the most common ways that I could train someone to increase their muscle size would be to do a lower weight and more repetition, so what we call a higher volume. So in fact, building strength without building too much size would be done by having a heavy weight done a few repetitions, whereas to build more about size would be about a lower weight but more volume.
So sometimes the myth is actually
doing what it's not, the opposite of what it says it's going to do.
So people always think that heavier something is, the more it's going to make them bigger. That's it's right up there with someone. There was a famous American PT who claimed that if you did exercises that where you opened your arms out wide, that would make you wider. It's right up there with terrible things like that. And cycling will make your legs bigger. And things, it's just not true.
Okay.
Thanks, Jason. Let's talk about spot training. Thank you, Anjali, for this question. Is spot training effective? And I think that's a simple idea that you can exercise to lose weight in certain areas of your body, or in fact, increase muscle definition in certain areas of your body. Is that how you see that spot training?
So spot training, yes, it can. It is a It's something you can do. Now, there's two parts to that. So if I went to the gym and wanted to train on just making my biceps bigger, I could, or, you know, look, have, be more defined, have more muscle mass. That's absolutely possible. But that is a combination of exercising to lower body fat and also to build muscle to increase that definition. Now, building muscle in individual areas, completely possible. You can choose the way you work and in the range in which you work to target specific areas. But you cannot burn body fat in a specific area. It's not how our bodies work. The way we store body fat and the way we do that hormonally, you're just burning it as a general fuel over your body. It's burning it as a part of who you are. When people get to the point where they're like, oh, I got these stubborn bits of body fat, that's just one of the last bits to go. Doesn't mean what you're doing isn't working. It's just that's the point where it's going to stay. And normally, and really that there's a real reason for that, and again, something people often don't know, is that happens to be under the arms or under the armpit, top of the arms, top of the thighs, because that's where our lymph nodes are. So it's a protective measurement for our organs. For women, it tends to be around the side of the hips, and for guys, it tends to be right in the front and the belly, and that's because that's where our sexual organs are. So it's a protective measure. When our bodies are really smart with body fat, so it's not just random, it's there for a very deliberate evolutionary reason.
So we should be grateful for that body fat protecting our...
Evolution is incredible and has developed us this way to help us protect. And obviously in modern society, we're not getting chased by animals and having to hunt and kill. Yeah. So it's a bit unnecessary these days. And maybe in a good few thousand years, we might evolve away from the way we store body fat in certain ways. But for now, that's how it is. And you just need to be in a position where you're working harder, burning body fat and building the muscle mass in the area you want. That's how you're going to make the change.
So generally, training will take care of it all. It's just the stubborn remaining part.
Yeah, eventually.
It will eventually go, but that's just going to be the last bit because our body is trying. When we store body fat there, our body thinks we're doing that for a reason. I would say quite like hibernation. It's not quite that extreme, but it's the same point. If you give your body lots and lots of fuel, it's going to assume that there's a reason behind it. Equally, when we reduce it down, it understands, the body starts to adapt to that process and knows that you can use your body fat as fuel.
Very good. And related to all of that, here's a classic. You know, will sit-ups, crunches give me great abs? It's actually a case in point, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a good example of if anyone knows anyone who's got great abs, there's two reasons why. They'll probably be in pretty good athletic shape, they'll be physically quite strong, and they'll train quite a lot, but also they'll be lean because they're nutritionally very good.
Yes,
they probably aren't the people that hammer a couple of bottles of wine every weekend. They're not people that keep Krispy Kreme in business. They're people that probably eat quite clean foods, have good amounts of protein, quite low levels of carbohydrates, and exercise regularly. Abs are built in the kitchen is a bit of a statement, and that's kind of true. We all have abdominal muscles. It's just how visual they are. I think one of the comments I always like to make when this comes up is, if I was going to explain to someone about making their sort of around their waist smaller, now building muscle will make your waist bigger. So if you want to make your bicep bigger, you do exercises to make the muscle bigger. If you wanted to make it smaller, you wouldn't do anything. But when it comes to abdominal muscles, they work differently, because people might sometimes go, I don't want to work them, I don't want the muscles to get bigger because it's going to make my tummy bigger. So abdominal muscles are a little bit different on that, and that's something I've had mentioned to me before. So the way that they're organized are different, so don't feel like you can't do abdominal exercises because it'll make your waist bigger. There is a tiny amount of that will happen, but it will only happen organically around the rest of your torso and your hips as well.
Yeah, okay. No, makes sense. Well explained. Thank you. Here's a good one. Dad bods.
Are dad bods
an inevitable consequence of the aging process, and what can middle-aged men do about it? And that's from someone called Mario.
Look, the term dad bod is sort of, it's out there now. It's quite a term for people getting a little bit older and getting a little bit I wouldn't say out of shape, but a little bit in not the shape they once were. So having a storing a little bit more body fat around around their tummy, perhaps posturally not being quite as good. That's common. And yes, age has something to do with that. Absolutely. As we get older, our bodies naturally want to have a little bit more body fat. That's really normal. And hormonally, our testosterone levels start to drop down. We begin to function not quite as well, basically, hormonally. We don't burn as many calories quite as actively. So we have to adapt as we go through that point of getting older. So if you go from 30 to 40 and you try and do exactly the same thing every day, you won't be in the same shape you were when you were 30 because your body will start to slow down a little bit. Now, you can keep training and work on, you know, building more muscle mass to keep your metabolism higher, but that's something that you should do before things go south, as it were.
Yes.
Than necessarily as a response to that. Again, like I mentioned earlier, we do store, especially men, we do store our body fat as a protective measure in the front of our tummies. So it's not unusual to do that. And again, that's one of the last places where we'll reduce body fat. So you might see people that have a lot of body fat around their tummy and their belly, but not very much anywhere else, because that's, again, where our bodies are sort of nudged evolutionary wise to store it. So if that's the last bit that you have, keep going. You're not failing. Yes. It's just the next bit the last bit that will go is that excess that's in front of the tummy. So
okay,
great. Can I exercise too much?
Yeah, you can. It's quite hard to exercise too much. It's quite a lot. And I'd probably put in brackets that exercise can also mean activity. So normally when we meet people that are exercising too much, it's not the actual time in the gym that's the problem. It's outside of that, they are running around after children, they're maybe going on long cycles, they're walking 10,000, you know, 10 kilometers more, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. They're really getting to the point where their body's not able to recover. And recovery is incredibly important. We talked a little bit about building muscle earlier, and when you work your body to a point where you get some soreness, you get some inflammation, that's actually the repair process going on. And if you don't let that happen, if you go back to working those muscles again, you avoid that repair process. Your body just will, your lymphatic system will just get rid of all the byproducts, and you won't repair at all. In fact, you'll actually get a little bit weaker because you're not giving yourself the ability to recover. You're creating micro tears and going into a position we call overtraining. Now, that's really difficult. That's quite hard to do. If you train 5 days a week, Monday to Friday, because they're the days you're in the office. If you did the same things every day, you'd probably get to a point by the end of the week where you're overtraining. You could probably do, you know, in 1 week, if you did your upper body session, you know, upper body work 3 times a week and your lower body 3 times a week, you'd be okay. You'd probably get a bit sore and it wouldn't be that comfortable one of the days, but you'd probably be okay with it in terms of what you could physically do. But it wouldn't necessarily be good for you. We generally recommend to people that training, you know, sort of resistance training, particularly 3 or 4 times a week, is more than enough. That recovery process we talk about isn't just purely what's happening in your muscles, it's also a hormonal response as well. If we overdo that, we increase some of our stress hormones, cortisol and noradrenaline particularly. If they spike up, you won't be able to build muscle, you won't be able to burn fat, and that's just the opposite of what people are trying to do.
Yes, but the truth is, the rest part of all of this is as important as the exercise.
Absolutely, and rest is quite a loose term. Rest doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean bed rest. It doesn't mean, you know, you've got to sit and watch Coronation Street. Or something like that. Whatever people listen or watch these days, I guess. Netflix, who knows? But it might be that on that day off, instead of doing heavy resistance stuff, you might come and do something that's more mobility based. It might be that you come and do Pilates or yoga, or come in and use your foam roller or use your trigger point balls and things like that to help you move better. It might be that you come in and do cryotherapy to help your recovery. It might be that you get a massage. So it's rest is a term away from doing resistance training as opposed to bed rest.
And quality of sleep is also part of that
equation as well, isn't it?
Hugely.
Probably quality of sleep is decreasing, isn't it, with time and blue light and all the other distractions.
We live in an incredibly distracted age where, you know, if I explain to a client that they need to put their phone in another room before they go to bed, it seems unfathomable that that's something that people will do. So Yeah, it's tricky. Sleep is important. If I stopped 10 people on the street and asked them how many hours of sleep they got, maybe one out of the 10 might get 8 hours sleep at best, especially, you know, the part of London that
the long broken sleep as well.
Yeah, a good sleep. So and people put no time and interest into it. They put their head down, shut their eyes and wake up in the morning and go again. And there are many things that can influence it, many things, but little things that people do, trying to get a good sleep pattern in terms of regular sleeping times is really, really key. Your body does adapt to that as well. If you can't get 8 hours sleep, or you can't get up towards 8 hours sleep every day because of work, children, life, whatever happens, then it's more about being consistent. Consistency is the next sort of part of it, really, is if you can only get six routine. Hours, get into that routine, know that your body will start to adapt and know that at 11 o'clock, head hits the pillow, that's it, go to sleep.
And well, these days, like a lot of things now, we can measure quality of sleep, can't we?
We can. There are many, many products out there and wearables that people have. You can put your phone under your pillow, which I don't necessarily recommend, but there are watches, there are rings, there are lots of products they can do. So if anyone doesn't sleep well or struggles in the morning, then tracking your sleep is the first step towards figuring it out, and speaking to a professional. Most trainers will be very versed in these days, but again, your doctor will be able to advise you towards people that can help you kind of improve those things. And ultimately, if you're not sleeping well, you're not going to do anything else well. You're not going to burn body fat well, because hormonally you won't be in a good position. Same for building muscle. You'll have memory function, cognitive function will drop down. You'll perform, you know, whether it's work or studies, you won't be as good. People put no time in sleep because, you know, people say, oh, I'll sleep when I'm dead or something like those kind of throwaway comments. But ultimately, you're just not very good. And anyone that is doing that and is getting away with it for now, it's going to catch up with them sooner rather than later.
Should you always stretch before exercising as well as after?
I think I would probably change the word stretch and replace it with prepare.
Good answer.
People always talk about, oh, I need to stretch afterwards and before, and sometimes it's not relevant at all. Preparation is the key, and sometimes that might include some stretches, but it might include some release work for certain muscles. It might involve some activation work for muscles. It might be some movement preparation. So if your exercise sequence is going to involve some hinging or some lunging, you need to prepare your body for the fact that it's going to hinge and lunge.
Yes.
So it might be doing unweighted versions or unresisted versions of those exercises.
So it should always be related
to the exercise you're about to
100%. If I had a pound for every person that's ever asked me, you know, if I'm going to go running, what stretches do I need to do? And then when I tell them that they need to run to get ready to run, they find it sort of quite crazy, but most people don't prepare themselves to run by doing some running. And that's really easy. It's a really easy way to start to get your body used to it. And we're not talking sprinting, but start to get into the patterns where you're creating the hips flexing more, the knees lifting more, the hamstrings are kicking and extending backwards. If you do those things, you're prepared. So yes, preparation before, you know, and even afterwards. It's not necessarily preparation afterwards, but it's preparation for what you're going to do in 2 days' time, because you're preparing your body to deal with what you've just done as an exercise session. So again, that might be doing some cold shock therapy or something to reduce inflammation. It might be even little things like eating and drinking well, making sure your fluid levels are high, you know, making sure we're not getting into an electrolyte disbalance, for instance, so making sure your sodium levels are at a good balance, which... Again, some people, you know, knowing these things isn't easy. Most people often know when these things aren't good because their body doesn't work the way it should. You know, that's, again, 10, 15 years ago was a valid argument for people, but in this day and age of information, it's just not. The ability for people to go and get a blood test, a full workout blood test, explaining to them where they are hormonally, where they are in terms of, you know, the vitamins and minerals in their bodies, is pretty cheap and also so readily available that you can buy a pack that's sent to your house. You find a walk-in nurse, which in London is probably one every 250 yards, and then you send it off in the post. It's very accessible, and again, something that we champion here at Lanzerhof is that, you know, as members come in, we recommend they see the nurse, they see the doctor, get these things tested, because you can train hard, you can sleep well, you can do all these things. But if your body's not in a position to adapt, you're just being inefficient.
Jason's referred to a number of our services here, and for more information, email lanzerhoff@theartsclub.co.uk. Thought I'd get that in there. Does exercise increase your metabolism and your metabolic rate? And let's talk about the function of age in that. You know, it does slow down with age.
Yeah. Yes, it can do, absolutely. Getting the body into a habit of working more. You know, we all get into the tradition of generally being more active, being happy, more active, and organ function can improve. Mm-hmm. In terms of metabolically specifically, and our metabolic kind of activity, metabolic rate, as some people will know it, having more muscle is the best way to become more metabolically active. If you have more muscle mass, you will burn more calories on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And again, really easy statement for people that want to change their body shape and go, well, I want to burn fat, I don't need to build muscle. Well, actually, the best way to burn fat is to build muscle. And anyone who wants to do that, that's a really easy way to do it.
So actually, weight training is more beneficial in speeding up the metabolic rate
than absolutely
cardio training, for example.
Yeah. Cardiovascular training is not the best way to burn body fat. Mm. I know we sort of
see. I think that there's a myth there.
Yeah, there's right a myth there. In itself. Yeah, people go and we see it all the time. People come in, they go on a bike, they think they need to hit a certain heart rate zone, and they do it for 40 minutes a day. And after about 3 weeks, they realise they're not making any change whatsoever. Mm. Heart rate zones. If your heart healthy, like your cardiovascular is healthy, heart rate zones are a pretty dated science. You need to get to a position where you're creating an adaptive response. Yeah. Okay. Again, if you have certain cardiovascular measures that you need, if you've been to see a cardiologist and you need to be fitter in certain areas, there is some premise to it. It's not completely dated for that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of healthy individuals trying to improve their cardiovascular function, it's just not true. You need to do something that's going to challenge you. You need to get a little bit outside your comfort zone and continue to do and repeat it on, say, a weekly basis. And as it gets easier, make it harder.
Well, actually, that maybe leads us to the next question that came up. And that is about HIIT training, high-intensity interval training. Is it too good to be true? Because generally, you know, it's shorter amount of intense time. Does it really reap the benefits that it says it does?
High-intensity training... interval training isn't bad, but a lot of people it becomes the only part of their training. One of the hardest challenges I have with the people I train is getting them into a rounded training program that includes resistance training, includes some sort of mobility work, includes some intensity work, includes post and pre training recovery and preparation, being active enough to move enough steps every day, to sleep well, all of those factors. And in high intensity is one of those things where people just come in, they're like, well, half an hour's enough, I'll hammer it. And again, it's just not going to make that much of a change. You're going to get a good cardiovascular response, and you may be a bit fitter from it, but it's not enough repetition or enough volume to increase muscle mass.
Yeah.
Probably, again, specifically more for females than males, it's such a dramatically intense thing that it creates a big hormonal response that isn't positive, or it takes a long time to end up being positive. So it's not to say high intensity is bad, but you need to be fit to be able to reap the rewards from it.
I see.
So a lot of people do it because they want to get into training and burn body fat, and they're like, high intensity is more calories burned, but that's really the only part of it. It's like reading a back of a pack of a food item and reading the nutritional part and just reading the calories. There's lots of other information that are relevant to that as well.
And with high intensity training, do you also reap the benefits of calories being burnt post exercise as well? Is that true?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, and that's the same for all exercise effectively. Post exercise oxygen consumption is true. It is. We continue to burn, but again, some of that comes down to, again, how hard you can work as well. If you're fit and you're strong and you can work really hard in a very good state, you'll continue to do it more. If you're very unfit and you're doing high intensity training, you're getting very out of breath, you're having to sit down, again, you're going a little bit beyond the point where that's going to be relevant in terms of the calories you burn compared to where you end up being kind of a bit skewed hormonally as well. So yes, it you can be, but it has to be at the right time for you.
Yep. And when is the best time of day to train? Does that have an impact on results?
Yes. Yes, it can. It's really easy for me to say there's a certain time. It's probably the thing as a trainer that is the hardest for me to figure out and get with people is understand when they can train and when's best for them. Some people, they will only be able to train at 7 o'clock because after that they go to work, they don't leave work till 7, 8 o'clock, they want to go home, tuck the kids in, and there's no other time that they can get to the gym. If that's the case, it doesn't matter when's best for you, that's the best time, because otherwise it's no time.
Yes.
There are some studies and some science about what we call circadian rhythms, which is the point in kind of which your body's functioning the best. Some of that was based on sort of when Olympic records and things like that were set as well. I think it was Vanderbilt University in America did a big study on this with Olympic athletes as well. And I think it was anywhere between sort of 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. is that sort of optimum time. Like that's when most world records were set.
Okay.
So sometimes some events have actually changed in the Olympics on when they are during the competition to make sure that
to enable
peak performance in the finals. So the 100 meters final is always in that time window. It's never first thing in the morning.
No, it's not, is it?
Never. And it has nothing to do with schedules. It is entirely to do with the superstars of that world. They want the it's good for the sport if the superstars break world records.
Of course.
So that's why they give them the most opportunity to do so.
Got it. And is there a best time? So we talk about best time to exercise, but is there a best time to eat after exercise? Is it immediately?
There's a window post-training in terms of getting protein in for what we call optimal protein synthesis. So if you're trying to build muscle and recover from exercise, protein's really important. So again, you have a window really that sort of degrades up to about an hour after you train. If you wait over an hour, you're probably going to get very little protein response to what you've done training wise, unless you've had a lot of protein previously. That's why protein shakes and protein supplements exist, so you don't have to literally have your dinner when you leave the gym. You can just have a protein shake and have it as you go, because that window of time is short, and the longer you go, the less response you're going to pick up. So generally you want to get some sort of protein in reasonably soon. It doesn't have to be overly imminently. If you're an elite-level athlete, it's a little bit different.
Yes.
But for everyday people, 15, 20 minutes, if you can get some protein in, that's probably a good thing.
And what do you recommend as the best sources of protein for post-exercise intake?
Again, you need effectively what we call a full spectrum of amino acids. So amino acids are basically the building blocks of life. Everything's made out of it. There are different ways of getting it. Obviously, animal products are a large source of it. Eggs, chicken, steak, salmon, etc., all very good. But again, we live in a culture where vegetarians and vegans, and veganism is much more popular these days. So there are, of course, other ways of doing it. If you are vegetarian, if you are vegan, the amounts you need to consume are much more challenging without those products. So supplementation becomes key. So having pea or grass or hemp protein supplementation is recommended, just to get the full spectrum of amino acids and to get the right amount in.
Good. We're getting through these questions, Jason.
Does
fasted cardio burn more fat? I think I know how you're going to answer this.
Yes. And the short answer is yes, but it's really complicated. Is what the sort of caveat I want to put onto it. There's kind of two stages of fasted cardio. So there's fasting to the point where you're kind of reducing the amount of glycogen stores, your sugar stores within your liver, and keeping the glycogen stores within your muscle. And then there's sort of a second level, which is getting to a point where you fast so that your muscles have low glycogen. Now, level two, where your muscles are low on glycogen, is not for everyday people. That's for elite athletes only, because again, the technicalities of it are incredibly hard to get to. For kind of that level one, that sort of low liver glycogen, again, you're looking at a good amount of time, and I think it's somewhere around 16 odd hours of fasting would be required prior to cardiovascular training for that. Now, if I ask most people to take 16 hours away from eating before they then do cardiovascular work, they're actually going to be a little bit low on energy. And that's where the
improve.
Presumably there's risk, some risk with that, is there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, yeah. Again, in terms of how you feel and your response to it. So energy is important for creating a lot of the responses we have. And if you're low on energy, again, we then get a hormonal response that comes with that kind of cortisol response as well. So fasted cardio is really complicated. It can be a really good way of doing cardiovascular work, but you have to be in a position, you know, in your lifestyle to do that well. Mm-hmm. For most everyday people, it's just very, very difficult to get right. And if you get it wrong, it's just you're making it worse.
Yes.
So I don't recommend it very much to my clients. I think it's far more complicated than it needs, you know, for that, for what most people need in terms of burning their body fat. Mm-hmm. There are better ways and better things that we can do and more controlled ways of doing that to start with. Mm-hmm. And then as we get further down the line, as people get, what if people want to get incredibly lean, if they want to be a bodybuilder, if they want to really create a position where they're burning lots of body fat and getting very, very lean, then that's where you need to get to. But it's really not something that everyday people need to worry about, and they need to spend far more time thinking about making sure they've got enough muscle mass, making sure they're active enough, and that kind of calorie balance we mentioned earlier about perhaps reducing the amount of calories they have every day is a better way of burning their body fat to start with.
And for those interested in fasting generally, of course, our fasting programs here are supervised, medically supervised by Dr. Levine. But in all these examples, you know, do take the relevant appropriate advice through trainers and doctors. Getting towards the end now, Jason, caffeine and coffee, consuming coffee just immediately prior to exercise, that we've seen that creep in now over the last few years. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll see it. You, just about every personal trainer in the world seems to drink coffee except me, I think. I thoroughly recommend it. I you know, there's a limit. I think for a lot of people, I actually refer them to having caffeine supplementation as opposed to drinking coffee, just because if you drink have an espresso, it's probably all right, but you have a flat white before you train, you're probably not going to be feeling your best halfway through that training session. So supplementing some caffeine, just because of how it works as a stimulant, how it creates a mind muscle response and creates alertness, especially for people that train early in the morning, for instance, you can actually get a better, you can train harder, you can train better, you can do more repetitions, you can get a little bit more out
measurable?
Of it.
Is that measurable? Is it actually quantifiable?
Yeah, it's absolutely, I mean, there's quite a lot of studies about, it's not hard to find a few of them in terms of, the response from caffeine, but it's definitely something we'd recommend. Mm-hmm. You're gonna have an increased alertness. You're gonna have increased stimulation neuromuscularly. That's gonna be able to give you more work. And if you work harder, whatever your goals are, whether you're trying to do more repetitions of weight, trying to work harder in terms of cardiovascular work, it's just gonna enable you to do that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I thoroughly recommend it.
Okay, and let's finish with supplementation, vitamins and otherwise. Do you recommend that? Let's talk generally.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously we mentioned again a little bit earlier about blood testing and really making sure there are supplementations which are specific for you. And that might be metal minerals. It might be zinc, magnesium, iron, things like that, that some people end up being a bit deficient in. Mm. The more common things that we see in the gym, and probably the most prominent one, would be creatine. Mm. Creatine is one of the most cheaply produced supplements in the entire, in the entire world. It literally is a natural product that we create in our kidneys, and I would recommend that every single person on the planet takes creatine. It's hard to make this not too scientific, but it works from a training point of view as a buffer. So it means that point where we become a little bit more acidic within our cells during training, as we produce more lactic acid after the byproduct of training. Taking creatine will actually buffer that a little bit and mean that if you could only do 8 pull-ups before, taking creatine means you should be able to do 9. So it just enables you to have just that little bit more high end.
How do you take creatine?
Creatine comes as a powder or as a tablet. You can take it just as part of your normal day. You don't need to take it specifically pre-training. It's just something that you should have during the day, and your body has it and maintains it. So definitely that. It's also had some really awesome science in the last few weeks, actually, about its mental acuity and the way it works for the brain, helps for the brain synapses. Really? So you actually feel smarter and sharper if you take creatine every day. Mm. And even for those that suffer with depression, actually, there was a really interesting article and journal produced I think it was in Germany recently, about links between people who have depression and taking creatine actually helping their kind of as a mood enhancer as well, and helping and helping helping people feel, you know, less likely to drift back into it. So it's a win-win. There are no bad sides to creatine.
There are no downsides.
There are literally none. So we should take creatine.
I'm making a note of that.
And it's really cheap. Like, it's literally the cheapest supplement you can buy. So it doesn't even, there's no reason why people shouldn't do it.
There we are. Jason, you have sailed through these questions.
Wow.
Didn't trip up once. Thank you. It has been enlightening and an education. And for those of you listening that know Jason and our excellent team of trainers, we look forward to seeing you here soon. For those listening that would like more information, please do email lanzerhoff@theartsclub.co.uk. And Jason, once again, thank you very, very much.
No, thanks for having me. I hope everyone learned at least one thing new and can take some things to help improve their training.
I'm off to buy some creatine.
Fantastic.
Cheers.
Thank you. Bye.